Maura, thank you for cleaning up the board. It actually, most of it can be read.
I didn't finish. It's purple.
Well, it's a lot better.
I think we all had it in our head from yesterday, so
yeah.
It doesn't
mean
it.
Yeah, but this looks a little better, right?
Yeah, it
looks better.
I wouldn't refine it anymore.
It actually looks like English.
But it's the arrows.
Yeah, it kept. See, I told you. Yeah. Whoever I was talking to, that some of the arrows.
It's getting more circular.
There we go.
It's going to
happen.
I need some post-its. We could do, with all due respect to the circle, we could do post-its all around.
I think we can.
Take a picture, then take it all down.
If I can, if there's another board back there, I'll see if I can.
You are savvy.
I could.
Could you take out the word, the extra word? You know, you say consciousness twice. Could you take that out?
Where do I
make a circle?
Fabrication.
Well, that's what makes
it consciousness.
But in the circle,
just make a zero form.
That's an interesting
space for a circle.
But yeah, if you leave, if I got to think about that.
Well, see, because they're all name and form become
Right. But in a circle, you wouldn't repeat the words.
Definitely. Wait. Calm down. We're going to see if there's another board. And if there is, there's probably one. What do you have, a flask of vodka there?
How it looks
I know Maura's passed. We'll do it on the other board, and we'll represent that through a circle. I think that'll be a nice afternoon task since we have a lot of free time.
Wonderful.
I think
that's
it is,
the
too.
The beauty of a sangha.
Now we can put the Four Noble Truths inside.
What is
happening? We're in danger of creating a whole new Dharma here.
It's visual basics, visual Dharma.
Yeah. Okay, that's what we're gonna do. We're gonna good morning, everyone. How's everybody doing? Is there anything that needs to be addressed just as far as the facility or the ongoing retreat? Meals? Anything? Laundry?
Even the kimchi is good.
Isn't it? Yeah. The food is just unbelievable.
It's not as hot as I remember.
I actually put a little hot sauce because it wasn't quite as...
Maybe they got peanut.
So, I know the retreat still has another day plus to go. But we're in a very interesting area where there's three major monasteries right here. One is Mon Dharma Center, which is the North American seat of Mon Dharma, which is a Korean form of Buddhism. James, Woodstock is about 35 miles from here, if I remember.
Yes.
So about 35 miles from here is the town of Woodstock, which isn't completely related to the festival, but it was held someplace else. In the town of Woodstock is the North American seat of the 16th Karmapa, Karma Triana Dharma Chakra. It's a
KTD.
The Karmapa is the head of the Kagyu lineage, which is one of the five still extant Tibetan lineages. Which
one that's not
the other one.
It's not the Dalai Lama.
It's the other one.
This is the one that was pushed by the Chinese instead of the Dalai Lama.
No, that's the New Kadampa tradition.
Okay.
Something else, and I will not talk any more about that. The 16th Karmapa is this really incredible young man. I don't think he's 30 yet, and he's the head of this gigantic, important Tibetan Buddhist. He's on par in a lineage sense with the Dalai Lama, and he's just as brilliant. And his big concern is two things: is the environment and children, and he's doing such a beautiful job with that. So, this is the North American seat of the Kagyu lineage, right in Woodstock, on top of Meads Mountain. It's a magnificent place. Their meditation hall is it's just incredible. It's almost too good to be true, because it's hard to. You can, if you want to learn about the Tibetan culture in relation to Buddhist, the Buddhist religion as it's practiced there, go to the monastery and just look about what's on the walls and how it's set up. It's really amazing. And just down the street from Mead, from KTD, go down Mead Mountain Road and you come into the little town of Woodstock, which is a great little town. The reason why I'm saying this is maybe Sunday when you, if you want to wander around before you head all the way back home, stop there. There's some great shops. There's a little restaurant in town called the Garden Cafe, which is a great vegan, or is it just vegetarian place?
Vegetarian.
Neat little shops. If you start heading out of town, heading west down Tinker Road, you'll come to one of my most favorite little juice bars, and it's actually a food market too. It's one of the reasons why I considered moving up here. It's just such a good place. It looks like a garden, like a landscaping garden kind of stop from the road, but really good food. Keep heading out of town. You'll come past one of my favorite restaurants called the Bear Cafe, and I think they're open for lunch on Sundays.
Almost every week when John says, if we say, let's have dinner, it's like, can we go to Bear Cafe?
Yeah, it's a little bit too far. So what I'm doing, this is an experiment. I'm trying to instill craving and clinging in you and see what you do with it. If you continue out Tinker Road and the name changes and you wander around and you come into the town of Phoenicia, just outside, Phoenicia's about this big, and you just go outside of town, and just outside of town is Zen Mountain Monastery, which is another significant monastery in the Zen tradition. John Dato Lori founded it quite a few years ago. It's called the Mountain and Rivers Order. And the reason why I bring that up, if you feel like doing it maybe Sunday or come up, and you can see, you've seen this place. You can stop at KTD and you can get a real good understanding of what the Tibetan tradition is about. And if you compare just the meditation hall of the Tibetan tradition, and you can actually compare it to where we've been here, and go down to Zen Mountain Monastery, and you'll see a complete difference. And the difference is rather stark and direct. And they're both interesting when you consider what they're trying to teach. And they're both appropriate. And it's just an interesting way to look at it. I think Zen Mountain has their services on Sunday, so you might even get the tail end of that.
9 to 11:30. So it'll be lunch.
Yeah. Well, and then they have a big, you know, a community lunch there. They're big on noodles, so you'll get a lot of noodles.
But, pasta.
Yeah, they're big. They're very big on pasta.
Very good.
So that's where we are.
Can you just drop in any time?
Oh yeah, yes. That's the point. Either one of those places. KTD, they actually built a new dorm a couple years ago. Really, it's just a nice place to go. I think it's about $90 a night just to hang. What?
Great bookstore.
Great bookstore, especially if you want to learn about Tibetan Buddhism.
Or any, they have everything.
That's true. They have really good food, and the same thing. I think you can drop in at Zen Mountain still. I'm not sure.
With your children?
Oh, at KTD, you certainly can. I don't think your kids would feel as comfortable at Zen Mountain as you would at KTD. And I think the food's better at KTD because it's more than just noodles. Well, they're Tibetan. They're not Zen folks. So that's what's available to us up here. If you feel like wandering.
Blue Cliff is
a good hour and a half from here. But you know, it's still quite a ride. It's Sullivan County.
Yeah, but. Aren't we up here?
Well, it's not really.
From Woodstock, it's about an hour.
From here?
Yeah.
Well, from here, even more.
Okay.
And also, right in that same town is Shunyun's monastery,
too. Does the Usain Mandalas have a place near Binghamton?
They do, and they're still there. So. It's really interesting where we are and the different traditions that have taken root here. And if you drive about 140 miles south of here, there's the world headquarters of the Cross River Meditation Center. Jersey. Which is a place you don't want to miss. It has its own charms, and it has its own type of Buddhism there. You know? It's significantly different than what's up here.
We've got a great dog.
There's a wonderful dog associated with the Cross River Meditation Center that none of these other places have. So, we've had talks about the Buddha's life and what led him to seek understanding. what he discovered, what he rejected. And we learned last night that his very first talk was to his five buddies that he befriended along the way, and he explained to them the nature of his understanding.
Is it recorded who remembered the discourse?
The Four Noble Truths?
The first discourse.
Oh, that's a good question. I don't know who.
Kundana, that actually is the.
That's a really great question. I don't know who's the one who first recorded it, first remembered it, because it couldn't have been Ananda, because he wasn't that significant yet. So, and there'd be a clue if when I read the Pali how it begins, because if it does say "Thus have I heard," then we'll know it was Ananda that at least recorded it. But it would have been from not his direct memory. It would have been from what he had heard. The other renditions usually start a little bit differently. Very occasionally here, this is what occurred. And then you know it's not Ananda, but it's one of the senior monks that is relating this to the first Buddha. Everything was recorded in the first Buddhist council and then was reaffirmed throughout time. Which, you think about that, that's pretty amazing. I think it's because of that oral tradition that was well established at the time. And they honored that tradition. There's an article on my website that talks about this, to what the Buddha taught in relation to the Pali Canon. So,
John, did those five friends stay with the Buddha?
Every one of them. In fact, this will talk about what happened to them.
to be continued.
So, to continue with our story, about a month later, and this is remarkable in itself, about a month later, the Buddha is going to answer some questions that have been coming up now. The Buddha taught the Four Noble Truths, and the five bhikkhus, now bhikkhus, took it to heart, and then they started considering, well, if there's a process, dukkha occurs, and craving and clinging establishes and perpetuates dukkha, and there's a process here that can end, who's having the experience? What are you talking about, Siddhartha? What is the vehicle for having this whole process take place? What am I? What are you talking about here? When they first heard it, it made complete sense. And then they started getting these self-referential views and confusing themselves. And so the Buddha figured, I better explain this to them now, pretty quickly. At that point in time, a month later or so, there's now 1,000 people that have heard about the Buddha and they want to learn more. So, on one occasion, the Buddha was staying at Benares in the deer park at Isipatana, which is right near where this whole thing started. There he addressed... Oh, I'm sorry, I'm getting ahead of myself. It's still a group of five. Tonight we're going to learn about the 1,000 monks. There he addressed a group of five, now bhikkhus. Bhikkhus, form is not self. So you think about the scenario, though. The bhikkhus are questioning, well, how is this process taking place? Here I am, I'm solid. This is me, there's a person here. The Buddha is saying form is not self. Were form self, then this form would not lead to suffering. And one could have it be any form desired and stress-free. The Buddha is saying something that is so profound that it's hard to see at first. But if it's a true self, then you must be in control of it at all times. It's not subject to confusion, delusion, and suffering. If form was self, you'd be in control of it. It wouldn't be prone to suffering.
Can we say that again?
I'm going to read it again. Bhikkhus, form is not self. Were form self, then this form would not lead to suffering, and one could have it be any form desired. So I know that this is a little, I can see the wheels turning. Mine are too. Well, what does that mean? How can can I make it into a giraffe? Or a dog? Or a cat? Or a tree? Could I have hair? Could I have good legs? Since form is not self, it leads to suffering, and none can have it be any form, and none can have it be any form desired and stress-free. Now, he's not talking about we can take this physical form and create it into something else. We can't make this form be an angel. Or we can't make this form be Mickey Mantle when he had good legs. But what we can do is stop creating an identity based on that form, and it's that identity that he's talking about. Remember, the bhikkhus asked, what is it that's having this process? So now he's getting a little bit deeper into this thing that he will describe as the five clinging aggregates. Bhikkhus, feeling is not self, perceptions are not self. Fabrications are not self. Look at dependent origination. We start from ignorance, we start defining ourselves because of this. And he's pointing directly to this. Fabrications are not self, and consciousness is not self. So just because you think, therefore you're not. If these aggregates were self, they would not lead to suffering, and one could direct these aggregates as one wished. From ignorance, we've lost control of the whole process. We're no longer in control. We can't direct the process as we would like to, which would lead to our long-term peace and happiness. Since these are not self, they can only lead to suffering, and no one can have these aggregates, the five clinging aggregates, be as they wish. We've lost control of the process based on ignorance. Ignorance leading to mental fabrications, leading to this whole process. So another word for dukkha is ongoing confusion and delusion. We've simply lost sight of reality. So now getting to even more deeper and more important points. So bhikkhus, how do you perceive this? Is form permanent or impermanent? Think about that. Most of us would want to say initially, I'm permanent. But all we have to do is think a little bit about it. Form, of course, it's impermanent. So how do you perceive this? Is form permanent or impermanent? The five relied, it's impermanent, Venerable Sir. So then the Buddha asks, now, is what is impermanent, is that painful or is it pleasant? He's getting right to the heart of the matter. He's making them take a good hard look at yourself. Look what you've created. Is what you created painful or is it pleasant? Meaning long term. Now, is what is impermanent painful or pleasant? The bhikkhus answer, it's painful, Venerable Sir. They're starting to admit to themselves. The Buddha doesn't care if they get the right answer, except that he hopes that they do. He wants them to get the right answer themselves. He's teaching them true insight, vipassana, which is something else that's been somewhat misapplied. He's taking them down the insight road. Is what is impermanent painful or pleasant? It's painful, Venerable Sir. They never thought about this before. They never considered it because they didn't have a context in which to consider it. Now, is what is impermanent, what is painful, what is painful since subject to change, is this fit to be regarded as this is mine, this is I, this is myself? He's going beyond the fact that it is considered. He says, is it even fit to consider this thing a self? Is it fit, not in a cosmic sense either, is it fit in relation to this, what the Buddha is trying to teach? If you want to escape dukkha, is it fit to consider this thing that is prone to dukkha a self? Is that clear?
Mm-hmm.
Why do it? It's that belief that's causing the whole problem. He's pointing it out very clearly, very directly, right between the eyes. Whether you want it or not. So again, the question he asks, is it fit to be regarded as this is mine, this is I, this is myself? And they answer, no, Venerable Sir, it's not fit. So then he asks, is feeling permanent or impermanent? Is perception permanent or impermanent? Are fabrications permanent or impermanent? The second link. Is consciousness permanent or impermanent? Up until that point, they never even considered these things. They just assumed that because I'm feeling things and I've created perceptions out of those things and I created an ongoing train of consciousness based on that whole process rooted in ignorance, that must define me. Why? Because they never had another way of looking at it. Up until that point, there wasn't a right view and a wrong view. There was just a deluded view. There was no distinction because there was no understanding of dependent origination. Nobody thought about it first, yet, I should say. Nobody had that realization. The Buddha has now had that realization of how this happened, and now he's explaining it. He first explained it as Four Noble Truths, and now he's explaining the Four Noble Truths in a personal way. He's defining anatta, that which he says is not a self. Is feeling permanent or impermanent? Is perception permanent or impermanent? Are fabrications permanent or impermanent? Is consciousness permanent or impermanent? Tell me. And they say, all at once, all are impermanent, venerable sir. We get you. We know where you're going. Now, is what is impermanent, what is painful and subject to change, is this fit to be regarded as, I know I'm repeating myself, this is mine, this is I, this is myself. No, venerable sir, they're getting it. So bhikkhus, any kind of form, whether past, future, or presently arisen. So he understands conditioned mind is stuck in the past. It's present right in this moment, and conditioned mind always goes into the future because it wants to continue to establish itself, whether it's in the next moment or in a common belief in another future birth. So bhikkhus is any kind of form, whatever, whether past, future, or presently arisen, whether gross or subtle, meaning a soul that is traveling through the ethers, common belief, whether gross or subtle, whether in oneself or external, whether inferior or superior, meaning a mere human or a god, a deva, a deity, whether inferior or superior, whether far or near, must, with right understanding how it is, be regarded thus. All of that. This is not mine, this is not I, this is not myself. All of those things that we've thought are me, the Buddha saying, they're not me, they're anatta, not a self. That's the only interpretation that anatta has any real relevance to the Buddha's teaching. What you think of yourself is not a self, it's anatta. And so it follows, the Buddha continues. And so it follows that any kind of feeling, whatever, any kind of perception, any kind of determination, meaning fabrication, any kind of consciousness, whatever, whether past, future, or presently arisen, whether gross or subtle, whether in oneself or external, meaning we've created identities of ourselves and other things, but through attachment, whether inferior or superior, whether far or near, must, with right understanding, with right view of how it is, be regarded thus. This is not mine, this is not I, this is not myself. What you think of yourself is anatta. He's explaining to these bhikkhus who originally got the understanding of the Four Noble Truths and started becoming confused because of their self-referential views, he's now pointing out that it's those views that are confusing you. They're not a self. They're not rooted in reality. What is rooted in reality clearly shows that this is not me, this is not mine, this is not myself. All of those things that are components of the five clinging aggregates that we use to insist that this is me, the Buddha's saying they're not. They're simply clinging aggregates.
Question.
Yes?
Is Kandana one of them?
Kandana was one of these original five bhikkhus, yes.
Was he confused by that as well?
I honestly can't answer that because there's no reference to Kandana specifically. There's only a reference to this general confusion that's now arising, and the Buddha's addressing it based on questions like that they would ask him. You know, we kind of got what you're saying, Buddha, but what about this? And now that's the first main big question that came up from his initial teachings. Again, thinking about what we're doing here this weekend. We've recognized what the Buddha awakened to, and we're going through this process. He taught the first noble truth, then he taught what is the vehicle that's experiencing this process. And tonight we're going to learn how he explains how dukkha arises in this process, referring always to the three marks of existence.
So, anatta is how we understand the five clinging aggregates, and the five clinging aggregates are how we understand anatta.
Yes, I would say that that's so. Anatta and the five clinging aggregates are the same thing, but the Buddha teaches the five clinging aggregates to point out how this process is ongoing within a self. And the word anatta simply refers to your conclusions about yourself are wrong. Anatta could be the same. You could call anatta a few different things depending on the situation. One way is to describe anatta as karma. If you want to know what your karma is, it's what you're selfing. Another description of anatta is wrong view. So right view is the beginning, you know, what the Buddha's beginning. He started right view here, and he's deepening our understanding of right view by clearing up the confusion of who we are and what we are.
I think, I've heard you say countless times, you know, what we think of ourselves is not, you know, it's not who we are, right? And we've heard that many times, but I would say in this context, those questions, again, really get cut through conditioning mind.
Yeah.
They really do. And it just becomes crystal clear. And what I have gotten myself caught up in, and that's where I got stuck in the thicket yesterday, was of taking things out of context and this sticking to, and I can see how the bhikkhus would have said, but wait a minute, we get, you know, suffering, but ego not, what? You know, so bringing it back to the Buddha's skillful means of teaching, you know, pulling somebody into the experience, and I would say, you know, hearing those words today in this context again, it's just, yes, that's all one needs to focus on.
Yeah.
Is
yes.
Is this form? How do those questions roll again?
Yeah, there's that.
Is this form permanent?
Let me go back.
So
we have all day.
He's just going through every step.
You can't argue with that. That's why I said the Buddha never wasted a word.
Yes.
There's no ambiguity at all in what he's saying. You can't argue with it. And he's saying something in that way to get right to the heart of the matter, because as he's talking to these bhikkhus, he's also recognizing their conditioned mind running circles around these teachings. So, bhikkhus, form is not self. Were form self, then this form would not lead to suffering, and one could have it be any form desired, and stress-free. Since form is not self, it leads to suffering, and none can have it be any form desired and stress-free. I won't go through the whole rest of it.
Now, it's bhikkhus. How do you perceive this form? Where is it? Bhikkhus, feeling is not self-permanent. It's a question.
Is form impermanent? Was the question, something like that. That which is...
How do you perceive this form? Is form permanent or impermanent in the five? So read it from there. Bhikkhus, how do you perceive this?
Yeah, let me find it.
Well, maybe...
Bhikkhus, how do you perceive this? Is form permanent or impermanent?
Right, stop.
Impermanent. Form's impermanent.
Gold stars all around.
I
can't help getting the historical picture out of my mind. Imagine the Buddha awakened with what he knows, or at least considers, is the most important teaching that's ever been here before. And he's not living 2,600 years in the past. He's living in his present, right? And he's asking these questions and also wondering, is anybody really going to get this? It's still, there, I mean, I'm putting a little bit of conjecture and speculation in it, but I can imagine that he's still not sure if he can really teach this. He's only given one real significant teaching up until now. And he's asking this question, hoping, I think, with skillful desire that he's going to get the right answer. And he gets the answer. Impermanent, venerable sir. It's all impermanent.
Form permanent or impermanent?
It's impermanent.
I mean, that question, like, in terms of, like, going throughout our daily, I would say, you know, I'm going to use that question when I get traveled in a thicket. Is form permanent or impermanent?
That's great insight. You don't even have to use the word form. Is what I'm experiencing right now in this body, form, feeling, perceptions, mental fabrications, consciousness. Am I feeling something that's permanent? No. And so it's not me. I don't need to identify. And again, don't look at it in a cosmic or mystical way. That's not what the Buddha is referring to. The only reason I'm feeling an agitation over this, whatever this might be, is because I've identified with it. I've created a self about it. And it's that self that is non-existent, that is impermanent.
And I think I'll just say for me, the question, because I've understood that, I mean, I keep saying it a thousand times, is this permanent or impermanent?
You keep saying that. Do I say it too much?
No, it's good you say it a lot.
When I first met Maura, I said, are you a self?
But So, you know, you always say in meditation, recognize it as impermanent. And I'm like, yeah, okay. But
but
going through, is form permanent or impermanent? Is what is impermanent lead to suffering or lasting happiness? Therefore, there's no argument.
I find in arguing mostly with my family that if you grab this feelings, it's even more like right in your face.
Yeah.
You know, because I hear a lot, right? Well, this is how I feel.
Yeah.
And like
and that's the license to express it, isn't it?
Isn't, you know, how long have you been feeling this?
Yeah.
You think it's gonna last? And you know, so you can grab this process at the feeling factor as well.
Yeah.
So it's very powerful.
Well,
that's why it's there. That's
how
why
I feel
it's
really how I think.
What about
right?
Yeah.
Because feelings are much deeper than that. Feelings are pleasant, unpleasant, whatever.
Mm-hmm.
It's really how I think. This is what I think.
Feelings are the. It's the feeling are. You're right. It's so deep because it's the initial connection through contact with what's occurring in the world. Pick whatever it is.
Right.
It is. It's that base fundamental beginning of this whole process.
But if there's no connection to, you know, there's no permanence in any feeling. What about love for your own child or love for, you know, how do you if that's not permanent, then what is it?
Maybe you should. Why isn't it permanent?
Because it changes constantly.
And
your love for your children changes constantly from the minute you pick it up right out of, you know, out of the womb pretty much to you know, when they leave for college or later. It changes constantly. It's not one love.
And so we're talking about two different things here too. We're talking about an emotion and we're talking about a label given to what is really responsibility rather than love.
Yeah.
The responsibility is throughout a physical life, but that responsibility can be clouded by calling it love.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, we can do things. Who was I having a talk with? We had a perfect conversation with someone. It might have been you, Lorna, about an inappropriate expression of love. But from the person who's expressing it, it was completely appropriate. I think we were talking about something as innocuous as cutting hair. And a father, who was it with? A father was chasing their child around with the scissors.
Yeah.
Well intended, because he wanted his son to live what he thought was in accordance with the world we live in. From the son's point of view, it was the most horrible thing that could be done. Chasing, you got to cut your hair. The father's view was based in love. But the love was more of a responsibility to how that son should be living his life.
Mm-hmm.
And you could argue forever about different points of view and whether he should be doing this or not. The motivation was based out of responsibility, not really true love or true compassion.
Well, by the
right.
Of the
yeah.
Voice out of him,
yeah, that's, I mean,
yeah.
That seems to me like a little bit
yeah.
of a, you know, cutting your child's hair is a bit more about perhaps a societal perception of what that would be or whatever. That doesn't, to me, define the base love for your child that you brought into the world. And, I mean, I guess it's just
start poking into the word love. You know,
yeah.
Really start teasing that apart.
I can see that. I can see the care
and,
for and the responsibility.
Care.
That's
yes.
Care and action.
There's all these things, but everybody who takes the word love in his mouth is talking about something different.
Mm.
Yeah, that ongoing
perception of that word changes constantly.
Sure.
And your feelings towards that person change constantly. It is impermanent.
Mm-hmm.
And the ongoing concern about your child is not a reactionary feeling like we're talking about here. It does not even have to be clinging, although in most cases it is. And that's, again, it's not a terrible thing until you consider where that might lead. When the Buddha heard, this is well into his... I mean, he might have been around 55 or 60 years old. He heard that his dad was going to die. very shortly. And the Buddha was 140 miles away. And you would think that someone who is, if someone was completely detached from their feelings, who cares about the old man? He immediately put on his heavy robe and walked 140 miles to be with his dad before he died, thinking that I just want to be with him one more time. That's love. That's real love.
Yeah.
The Buddha didn't feel it because he had overcome the world. He was so deeply connected through the world and to a person that was as important to him as his dad that he got up off his behind and walked. I don't know if humans today would walk 140 miles to see their dad before he died. A lot of us probably wouldn't. We would think it's an inconvenience. So this doesn't negate being a human being. Remember, the Buddha taught this as a middle path between extreme views. An extreme aesthetic view would be, I'm beyond all of feeling. I've established, that's kind of what ascetics are trying to do. They're trying to get beyond having any type of feeling. The Buddha's teaching to have every feeling that you have without needing it to be any different. So I don't need to change the love for my child if my child happens to turn out to be like I was when I was 15 years old. And my parents never... one of the things that is amazing to me, because I was really a nasty little kid, but I always knew that my parents loved me. And that's what carried me through. I didn't realize it until much later. But I'd come home knowing that I'm going to get my behind kicked, and my father wasn't beyond doing that physically. But even while he was giving me a good whipping, I knew he loved me. It never changed. Even though their expression changed, and I certainly changed. I went from being this nice little... I was never really a nice little kid. But I got worse as I got older. But their love didn't change. It remained because it was love based on responsibility of a parent, not something fleeting as a reaction. Oh, my kid is perfect, and I love him. But, the first time he messes his pants, he ain't my kid no more. That love is over. That's not love.
So you're saying, I hear you saying that in the context you're talking about feelings here, that love isn't in that, this particular love that you might have for your child isn't in that feeling place, but there's something... We might misuse that word all the time, so there's something underneath that, this true love or whatnot, that maybe in general humans aren't really always tapped into what that really is, but it is there and unchanging. But the...
Everything is always in a process, so everything is impermanent.
Right, so love is this true love that we're talking about now, not just, I love my kids. Oh, I love them so much, I don't want to leave them at home right now and go on retreat. That's not the love I'm talking about.
That's a clinging love that could lead to something that's not entirely skillful, such as not going down the retreat.
Right, but then there's the, I called home, I talked to my daughter.
That's the responsibility.
She says something that moves me, and I respond in a skillful way with love or something.
Yeah.
So there's something, and that moves, that changes. Like, so the love was maybe this feeling of sadness that then moved into a response that then transformed into, moving on or whatnot and hanging up the phone and not getting the car ready.
Yes, and in that case, we're using the word love to describe the connection.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. But it's not necessarily the love that might have me chasing a young girl down the street.
Right.
I don't do that anymore, by the way.
So I just...
Again, but that would be, I really love that girl. What it is a physical attraction. It's the same word, but it's a completely different than what you're feeling for your children, isn't it?
Right.
But still love. Feel that that's an aspect of annihilation. It feels like annihilation.
Right. And so
I think entering into the process and sort of appreciating that it's just not what I think it is. It's just not what I think it is. And it kind of applying that allows me to see how love is an evolving, constantly becoming. Like today, yeah. Right now, I still love this person. And it just becomes like a process.
And what you said, it's not what I thought it was. That's right. The Buddha saying, teaching you the Buddha's teaching is anatta. It's not what you think it is. Let it go. Let me get to Mark before.
Just the thought I had there was, we're constantly changing as people. So that love is constantly shifting.
Yeah, it's a relationship.
And the example that I thought of was, you had given it in class a few times, there was a couple that you had studied with. And
Selma and Arnold Patton.
They committed their love to each other every moment because they're always changing. So that love is always evolving. And it is impermanent, but that doesn't mean that you have to be afraid that it'll slip away.
That's clinging.
Right.
And it may slip away. We've all had important people come into and out of our lives, and it hurt us, didn't it? And the initial hurt is appropriate. What happens then when we're clinging aggregates, when we haven't separated these aggregates, that can grow to anger or hatred or fear. We could be afraid to get into another relationship because I got hurt so much in the last relationship. We stop living our lives. So the Buddha is not teaching us a way to deny our life. He's teaching us a way to be fully involved in our lives. And isn't it interesting that here today, we're not talking about so much negative feelings. We're focused on, what happens to love when I awaken? That's incredible. We don't want to lose it, do we? And you won't lose it. You'll gain a deeper way of loving that you've never had before. And I think we're all building that.
Denise would love this.
We was on a retreat, I guess our first retreat. Denise is a bhakti yoga practitioner, means a devotional type of yoga. And she got to about this point, and she started just about shaking because I'm giving the usual talks, not the same retreat. She says, "Where's the love in all this? I need to hear about the love." And I had to think about it. The Buddha never talked about love directly, especially in a devotional type of love. But when you think about his whole Dhamma, it's about a real compassionate type of love. It's the most, I say it so often, the most loving thing I can do for myself and for all humanity is to take to the Dhamma and awaken. That's real love. We can be much more loving parents and children and friends and members of a society when we awaken. We don't lose the ability to love. We gain the ability to love on a very deep and authentic level that is informed by wisdom of understanding.
And we talked about that yesterday.
Yeah.
For me, that expression has been a fear of sharing and allowing that fear to subside and trusting that due to the impermanent nature of life, it will be okay. It'll be the process that it's intended to be.
Yeah.
And you made the great point that sunk in with me. That creates such a much more deep connection with the person that you're sharing that with. So you allow that fear to just go away. You put it down. And then you share that experience with that person. It's so intimate.
Yeah. It creates a level of intimacy that wouldn't be there if you were still blocked by your fear. So you shed these identities. And you become more connected with the people that are most important to you.
Right.
And it really is the only way to do that. People will spend thousands and thousands and thousands of dollars in therapy. Not that they shouldn't. Some people have to. So, you owe me something. Judy had something.
For birth in every moment with your children, because having adult children, from beginning to now, it's evolved, and it's my love now is different. It's less of the caring, physical, taking care of, you know, responsibility sort of thing. You have to let that go at some point because you still love them, but now they're responsible for themselves. Yeah. And there's less of that, but there's such a deeper respect for the people they've become. It's different. It's evolved, and it's just constantly changing. Yeah. And so I think there's always some love there, but it's always becoming.
It's different than it was. I happen to know. I hope I don't get too personal with you. You can tell me to shut up.
No,
I know Judy well, and this is I know she has this incredibly authentic love for her children. It's real, and it's not something that should be denied. It's something that enriches your life and theirs too. And now you just told me that you got a new son-in-law coming.
Yeah.
Hopefully,
no.
Hopefully, Katie
yeah.
said yes. The question was popped this weekend, so we don't know yet. But
right.
that's the middle way type of love. It's authentic. It's real. It's uplifting. It is in no way hurtful to anyone. How a clinging type of love could be. A smothering type of love from a parent to their children could destroy their kids.
Mm-hmm.
One of the most amazing things when I see Matt and Laura together and their kids, and if you want to see it, come to the Donna dinner Tuesday night, as kids, is the incredible authenticity in their family. It's amazing to see. I don't mean to put you guys on the spot. It's authentic. It's based on the truth of the Four Noble Truths and an understanding of it. It's not clinging. It's not smothering. It's not an ownership type of parenting, you know.
And that's the thing.
Yeah.
When the identity becomes attached to this thing that I made, that's mine, that I love.
Mm-hmm.
Now I'm not only am I responsible for it, but I own it. It's mine. Yeah.
Right.
And it's a burden, isn't it?
Right.
It's a burden rather than a joy.
Right. I'm tying all of my emotional reactions and expectations and desires to whether or not this thing that I created is mine. Whether it's mine.
Really?
And that's where we get stuck when we attach identity to it.
Rather than
the second that you fail to recognize the impermanence of that relationship, that's when it goes south as well.
Yeah.
And the smothering love is nothing but not dealing with the impermanence of the relationship.
Right. That's right, yeah.
And it goes straight down the drain.
What an incredible insight that's coming up here, right? I mean, it really is. It's really amazing. I was just thinking, one of my favorite suttas is the Rahulavada Sutta, where the Buddha teaches his 7-year-old son the dangers of lying and misrepresenting yourself. And it's just, in that little sutta, he's teaching his little 7-year-old son what a 7-year-old could understand about the entire Dhamma, teaching him the right use of mindfulness. That's real love. And that's not to say that in order to be good parents, we've got to teach our 7-year-olds the Dhamma. It's just an example of that. And I would say that we all pretty well express it here. Oh, so let me finish the sutta. Where was I? I was at an impermanent state. Okay, I'm going to probably go back just a little bit just to keep it in context. So bhikkhus, any kind of form, whatever, whether past, future, or presently arisen, whether gross or subtle, whether in oneself or external, whether inferior or superior, whether far or near, must, with right understanding of how it is, be regarded thus. This is not mine. This is not I. This is not myself. And so it follows that any kind of feeling, whatever, any kind of perception, any kind of determination or fabrication, any kind of consciousness, whatever, whether past, future, or presently arisen, whether gross or subtle, whether in oneself or external, whether inferior or superior, whether far or near, must, with right understanding or right view of how it is, be regarded thus. This is not mine. This is not I. This is not myself. And we can use that mantra in everything. When we feel something arising, whether it's a strong attachment or a strong aversion, it works both ways. Say that to yourself. This is not me. This is not mine. This is not myself. And it starts immediately to depersonalize whatever the experience is.
And then you can feel it a little more.
Pardon me?
Then you can feel it a little bit.
Then you can feel whatever is appropriate to feel.
Yeah, that's what I mean.
And it keeps, it helps to maintain right view. It helps stop the need to see it through the eyes of an ego personality and enter into that place of becoming, you know, selfing, impermanence, and liberation, or selfing, impermanence, and dukkha. You're entering into a state of becoming more mindful of what's important. This is not me, this is not mine, this is not myself. A simple way of saying is don't take things personally, because they aren't. And I want to talk about Selma and Arnold in a second, if I remember to. So it's just a beautiful story that explains something. But I want to go a little further. Bhikkhus, when a noble follower who has heard the truth sees thus, he finds estrangement in form. It's an interesting, I mean, this is obviously a translation, but I think it's a very accurate translation using this word, estrangement. What does it mean? It means now, from an awakened or a developing awakened mind, the identity with a self seems strange. You stop seeing that. Just like meeting a stranger for the first time, that old identity you've been carried around, you're now estranged from it. You see the difference. You've lost that identity. He finds estrangement in form. He finds estrangement in feeling. She finds estrangement in perception. She finds estrangement in determinations. She finds estrangement in consciousness. She finds estrangement in the five clinging aggregates. There's no longer that identity through that process. When one finds estrangement, passion fades out. What's another, what's the right word? Another, it's not...
Synonym.
Yeah, I couldn't think of the word. Another synonym for that is calm. That's an awakened mind. Remember, the Buddha described an awakened mind in no mystical terms. Calm. You're free of passion. You're free of the passion that's necessary to maintain an ego self. You let it go. You found estrangement in that whole process that leads to that. This is why I was saying yesterday, you don't need to memorize every link in the chain or even unravel it directly. All you have to do is develop estrangement, and the whole causative chains falls apart.
And you're going to do the fire sermon tomorrow, right?
Yeah, and that describes how this whole thing comes up. So, were you telling me that I'm done today? Because there is a little more to go. I know I go back, but I want to keep it in context, but still be able to comment. When one finds estrangement, passion fades out. With the fading of passion, that one is liberated. Simple. A little difficult to do, but it's simple.
When I was first looking in this space, the word dispassionate came up because I'm very passionate about my work, about what I do. I'm animated, so this was hard for me at first because
it
I
is. Yeah.
Hold on to, oh, I'm a passionate person, and that's why I'm good at what I do.
That's the view that you have of yourself.
Right.
And awakening doesn't mean you lose the... You don't lose the passion for it.
Right.
You just lose the self-identity about being passionate about it.
And the word dispassionate was helpful because it was an unemotional type word. It's not a negative version of passion.
Yeah. It just describes a quality of mind.
I sat with that word for a while to feel... You're right, to make myself one place removed from a view of myself.
Yeah. And that's a practical application. I can keep saying that over and over again. Sorry, Maura. That's how it works.
You can change that word passion to the concept of integrity. I have integrity about my
work. Yeah, that's right. Or even about the Dhamma. We talked about, Judy brought up, is it unskillful to have desire to awaken? It's a well-integrated life. It's living a life with integrity. To integrate the Eightfold Path. Well, it's just another way of saying the same thing, though.
And you can still feel passionate.
Passion
in your life, so...
Think about what maintained the Buddha for 45 years. It was his passion for teaching the Dhamma. Because he was passionate about people waking up. But he had no... He could do it in such an effective way because there was no Siddhartha there anymore. Mm-hmm. There was simply an awakened being with no real axe to grind except to do this.
Like the ego isn't attached to it.
Right.
Yeah, and then he was using the ego simply as a function of his mind, simply as a point of reference. This is where I am now. The best thing I can do right now is to teach the Dhamma, to give this teaching on anatta. And he wasn't increasing his own self-worth by doing it. It was just an expression of an awakened human being at that point.
He wasn't holding on tightly to whether somebody did awaken or not. He
yeah.
was presenting the information.
And that's another reason why he was so effective. Because he didn't care in a possessive way. He cared in a mindful way. He cared with authentic love. Not something that, you know, like, and again, there's so many stories of the Brahmins that kept, the Kalama Sutta is a great one. The Buddha comes into a town, the town of Kalama, and they said, and it happened to be on a trade route where a lot of different people wandered in and out, including different teachers. And the Buddha shows up with his teaching, and his reputation preceded him. They know that this so-called awakened one is coming to town to tell us what he's got. And the first question was, well, how do we believe you? We hear this all the time. How do we pick one? And he said, Ehepasiko. He said, come and see for yourself. But he didn't say it in the way that it's usually taken. He didn't say, come and see for yourself and walk away. He says, come and see. Try this on for size. Try that Eightfold Path on. And you will see for yourself that it works.
Well, that's what I was going to say, even about this whole discussion. It becomes a function of the ego unless you just... That's why I really love the way... it seems to be very effective, the way that it's presented right now, because you don't have to go into all that. You see for yourself does seeing form... as impermanent, not self, does that increase your love or decrease your love?
Yeah. So, Casey, you started a great discussion. Thank you.
Thanks for clarity.
So, I'm going to go back to the beginning, and then we're close to the end. So, when he finds, or when one finds estrangement, passion fades out. With the fading of passion, that one is liberated. When liberated... I didn't mean to say liberated. Did it sound like that? When liberated, there is knowledge that he is liberated. You know it. Just as the Buddha knew it when he first awakened. You know it. Nobody has to tell you. Nobody has to transmit it to you. You know it. That one is liberated and you know it. He understands this. Now, remember, birth is... We're not just talking about physical birth when the Buddha is referring to birth. He's talking about that ongoing process of becoming, mm-hmm. of giving birth to either another ignorant moment or a moment that is inclined towards awakening. When one is liberated, he understands. Birth is exhausted. The holy life has been lived out. What can be done is done. Of this, there is no more beyond. There's nothing else to do. So what do? Then you spend 45 years teaching the Dhamma or something else. So the Buddhist, he's not talking about annihilation. He's saying you don't have to mess with that ego self anymore. You're done with it. You've grown up. You've put aside the things of it that a child holds on to, and you're now awakened. You're a fully mature human being. There's no more becoming of that immature behavior. And I know, I'm using kind of harsh words too. But that's the best description of an awakened human being, besides the best description is what the Buddha says, unbound or clinging. I guess I think I can embellish it a little bit. So now, during this discourse, the hearts and minds of the bhikkhus were liberated from craving, aversion, and deluded thinking. There were now 5 arahants in the world. So tonight we'll get to the next discourse, on the fire discourse, where the Buddha explains the process of maintaining dukkha within us. Oh, I heard a big sigh.
4 down, 1 to go.
So, any questions about the Anatta Lakkhana Sutta?
That was really great.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Thank you. Again, it's thank you. You know, it's the Buddha that taught that. Those are his teachings, not mine. I'm just fortunate enough to have that. A little bit of an understanding that I can portray it. I'm not asking that, do you have the full understanding of the 5 bhikkhus? But maybe you do. But do you have a working understanding now of what the Buddha means by anatta, that it's not a self? And do you have a working understanding of how we either continue this process or we can understand the process and turn it towards awakening?
Can you repeat the five clean silence?
Yes. The first one is form. Now, let me preface it by saying these are, oftentimes when the Buddha would talk about an awakened person, he would talk about that awakened person in the form of five aggregates. The difference is they're no longer clinging together, and we're not using that clinging to define a self. So the first is form. The next aggregate is feeling. The next aggregate is mental fabric, is perceptions. Perceptions is the same as assumptions or recognition. Then mental fabrications are formed by that ongoing process. And finally, consciousness, but consciousness with a small c. It's an ongoing diluted train of thought that we're referring to now that has been created from that process of identity or clinging. Form, feeling, perceptions, mental fabrications resulting in that diluted consciousness.
And sixth sense base or no?
Nope. Well, not in that explanation, but that's part of it. So you could look at this and say this is the five clinging aggregates too. Yeah, it's just not as well delineated. When the Buddha described...
I like the simple.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, it's easier. It's easier to... Again, the Buddha didn't teach this until he probably mentioned, you know, a big guess, he probably mentioned the five clinging aggregates 150 times before he ever told this. He told this first to Ananda. Ananda was feeling full of himself one day and said, "I think I got it." And he says, "No, you don't. Let me tell you, dependent origination." And that's what took Ananda another 40-some-odd years after that one. So and when the Buddha described dukkha, remember, he start with saying birth is suffering, sickness is suffering, aging, etc., being separated is suffering, and then he concluded by saying, in short, the five clinging aggregates are suffering. And he could have said dependent origination is suffering, but he tried to keep it simple. So, I think what I'll do, because the question has arisen, I realize I really haven't addressed it, is I'll talk just a little bit about the five clinging aggregates tonight, not a full teaching, because Maura probably won't be there. She'll be clinging to something else. And then we'll talk about the fire discourse, and then tomorrow will be a talk on the three marks of existence, and then closing with the hindrances. So we still got a lot to do. Matt, you had a question or comment? A brief talk on it, just to put it in context.
The difference between the five aggregates and the five clinging aggregates is identity of the ego personality.
Exactly. And that it is that identity that clings the aggregates together, rather than recognizing the process. We're no longer attached to form. We're no longer attached to, again, it's so simple that it's hard to see. This is no longer what I'm using to define myself. I understand that I'm in an ongoing process, meaning that this physical body right now is not me. It can't be because it's impermanent and it's prone to suffering. But the next moment, here I am in the same body. I can't identify myself anywhere in that plane, in that simple one moment to the next, because it's impermanent. It's not based in reality. There's continuity. Continuity obscures impermanence. And at any time that I identify myself as this is me now, I'm this Buddhist teacher, and this is what I am, and it's all that I am, then that's going to start clouding what I teach.
And bring pain,
especially when my audience is not as gracious as you and tells me the truth. We really don't think you're all that hot. Well, they're not going to take it to heart. It's going to hurt me because I've created an identity of something that the outside world is now telling me you're not so much that. If I avoid, through this understanding process of creating an identity of anything, then what happens in result of that doesn't affect my calm, peaceful mind. And then it doesn't cloud me and obscure the most important thing that I can be, whether I'm a Buddhist teacher or I'm a lawn cutter. Because there's no identification, then I can just cut the lawn.
You know how they talk about the the worldly winds in Buddhism, fame and ill repute, gain and loss, and all these things. It's interesting because, again, if you just stick back to here, that's kind of irrelevant.
It puts it all in perspective.
I know.
Yeah. And because it points directly to impermanence. And it doesn't mean we shouldn't be passionate about what we're doing. We'll be more passionate because it's what we're doing.
Right,
we're fully
right.
present.
Exactly. And you can say, okay, well, yes, fame and blame, or, you know, all that fame and gain and loss, like, that should affect or should. Like, because it then becomes a mental retardation.
Yeah. Well, you put that last little appellation on there, but...
But
it becomes a very agitating, exhausting game that we play with ourselves.
So,
there's so much real energy that's freed up
back,
by just
yeah.
simply awakening. You don't have to keep putting all your energy into maintaining this ego personality that you can't maintain. But you can spend an entire physical life trying. And then you end up like that man at the Buddha first inspired him to go figure it out. What a waste of a life. I was talking to someone earlier today. What's most important in life than awakening? It doesn't mean that you won't continue to pursue your career, or you may not. You may decide you want to do something else. But the outside trappings don't change at all, or don't necessarily have to change. What changes is your inner understanding and your relationship to that. Tracy.
So, the five clinging aggregates, when they don't cling anymore, do they just become reference points?
Yes, that's a great point. So we no longer, through the form that is no longer clinging to feeling arises, and we cease creating a further identity from it. We just, and this is getting a little bit esoteric, but it's describing the process of an awakened human being who has a feeling, and it's just a feeling. It doesn't need to, it's just a reference point.
And
yes, that's a perfect example of what that means. Thank you for asking the question. It almost seems esoteric, but it only seems esoteric, meaning hidden. It only seems hidden because it's so simple and it's right in front of us. We're just a reference point in this continuing becoming that all that this is. That's why it is so it's so deluded and it's so hurtful to seek to establish the self in any form, in any place, in any realm, through any teaching, because it leads to long-term suffering. All those the stories that I've told mostly in class, I don't think I told one of them here, but about monks and nuns that go out and they contort the Buddha's teaching, and the Buddha calls them back in and says those words. Your confusion will lead to your long-term suffering and other long-term suffering. He's not trying to hurt people or call them bad people. He's pointing something out. It's the delusion that hurts us. Get rid of the delusion. You're just a reference point, and every one of those. So if this... I'm going to shut up pretty soon, maybe. We do have till Sunday at 1. The five unclinging aggregates then are just that. They're just the body's a reference point. Here's where I find myself. I happen to be in Clowerack, is how they say it. Is that right, Maura?
Clowerack.
It's not Clowerack.
She said Clowerack. That's how, I don't know.
I was told how wrong I was the first time I said it at dinner over there. Not Clowerack. No, I'm exaggerating greatly. So... we are just a reference point right here in Clowerack, on May the 21st, 2016. And if I had the time down to the split second, then I could say, and then the next second, we're another reference point. And something occurs, and I have a reference point of a feeling. I'm seeing Matt's smiling face. It makes me feel good. But I don't need Matt to keep smiling if the next... look as a frown, well, there he is. Yeah. Again, I'm using simple. And out of that, Matt's smiling face, because I have no reference point, simply enlivens me. But I don't need any more of it. It's what I'm enlivened in this moment. But I don't need to have Matt now in front of me for the forever to keep me enlivened, because I might look at Mary or Mark or Judy or any of you. And you might have a frown on your face, or you might look angry. And now, because the reference point is what's occurring here. And not to put myself in the Buddha's place, but now as the Buddha would be the reference point, he can now respond to that person who has a frown on their face. That's what people thought, that he could read their mind because he could look at someone, but he was just simply present with people. He was simply a reference point in that ongoing process of five unclinging aggregates. He was, another way of saying this is, he was using his human life in an appropriate way. An inappropriate way is to seek to be a self-referential ego self and insist that that's all you want out of life. I want what I want, what I want. And I want it when I want it. That's all gone. And you can be fully present. That's the true expression of the refined mindfulness that the Buddha taught. That's what dispassionate mindfulness means. It means I can be mindful of what's occurring without being passionate about it. And that will make even a little bit more sense tonight, if we get there. It means I have to stop talking now so we can have another period of impermanence, and then we'll get back into it. But again, I have to ask, are there any questions about what we talked about this morning, or this incredible discussion we had? Jen?
Well, this staring at this and listening has just inspired me to make a better chart. No, and I don't really want to. I just want a giant piece of paper and pencil so I can. Yeah, because I'm seeing concentric circles,
I'm gonna post this somehow on the website, on a community page, and so let's contribute these ideas to this in these drawings. I can imagine what I'm gonna get from Tony out in Billings, Montana, once he sees this. This is what we're gonna do. I think that's a great idea. Let's come up with our own meaning of what this is. I think that'd be wonderful. So we're gonna do it. Just so you know, I have a feeling that there might be some questions that might come up. We have a long afternoon. There's no class or anything. Matt will be teaching a Qigong after lunch, and then we're free for a couple hours. The reason why I'm saying this is before class tonight, if there's any questions before we get into that about this, then we'll go around the room and address those questions. And then we'll get into the fire discourse and a brief description, a little bit more in depth, of the five clinging aggregates. And there's a few other suttas in it. You got to hear these. It's again, excuse me for going on so long, but... A 20-minute meditation, good for everyone?
Mm-hmm. Can we just have a walk around or something?
Yes, please, yeah. Please. Stretch your legs. Judy, did you bring your table?
I'm sorry?
Did you bring your table? I'm just kidding.
You know, I was thinking that yesterday. I was walking with my friends, and I thought, especially with my table. It would be nice just to work on something. Just,
Oh, well. If you really want to fulfill that desire, I'm here.
Okay.
Judy is an outstanding massage therapist, for those that don't know. He's really amazing. What you can do with those hands.
Job I was really passionate about teaching. And Tom was like, yeah, so was that guy across your reservation. too much laughter. The world famous.
That's something I've been a part of, different monasteries and temples and meditation centers, and there's so little laughter there. I mean, I can't think of one that's like as silly as this group. You gotta have it, you know?
Oh, yeah. Especially with stuff this dead, you know.
Yeah, you do. If you can't make a little bit of lightness out of all this,
that helps it become, you know, integrated. It's like, you know, you're not taking yourself so seriously.
Well, and you can't. What we're pointing out is the absurdity of life. It's silly. To,
right. Well, if they don't have the humor, it's like, well, yeah, everything you did, well. Okay, well, I'm not leaving here like this. No fun. Some big clean area. This is no good. No, no good.
I've left 10-day sessions feeling like that. It's not fun. Rest in peace and happiness. Yeah.
So how can you not have humor?
Yeah. I think some of it has to do. I'm getting into some criticism. I think it has to do with it's the wrong message. It doesn't lead to happiness. So you don't feel it, you know. And like I said, I've been to long sashins, and I was happy when it was over, rather than. Some people got a lot out of it. I did. I was happy it was over. It wasn't an uplifting experience, you know. And maybe I guess that's influenced how I run retreats too. I don't want everything. You know, I like to laugh and smile a little bit. Yeah, I know. Boy, that looks good.
You'll get yours.
Just before Christmas, my son. Can we go for a ride?
Yeah, let's sneak 2 minutes of Matt. Talk about the ending of suffering.
Cheer up, Maura. Is everybody here?
No.
Okay, so we'll have a 20-minute meditation. Lunch is at 12. Matt is right after that. We have a free afternoon. We'll meet tonight again in the meditation hall at 6:30. Find your relaxed meditative posture. Gently close your eyes and gently close your mouth. And holding your back straight, but not stiff, your ears aligned with your shoulders, nose aligned with your navel, but holding yourself very loosely, very gently, very lovingly. Allow yourselves to settle into this room. Settle onto your seats. Settle into your bodies. And settle into your minds. And take a moment to become aware of the sensation of breathing in your body. Just get a feel for what that's like. To be mindful of your breath in your body. And while remaining mindful of your breath in your body, notice that thoughts are flowing. We're conscious beings, thoughts should be flowing. The purpose of Shamatha Vipassana meditation is to not be distracted by our own thoughts. So when you find that you're thinking again, simply acknowledge that and return your mindfulness to the sensation of breathing. I'll repeat that. When you find that you're caught up in your thinking again, simply acknowledge that and return your mindfulness to the sensation of breathing. And we'll meditate for 20 minutes. Take a moment to notice the quality of your mind. Be at peace with your mind. And when you're ready, you can gently open your eyes.